A small submersible goes missing after taking passengers to look at the Titanic up close, triggering a frantic search and questions about adventure tourism.
To me, signing a waiver doesn't really get the company out from the issues here because there was really no apparent backup plan.
I'm Marco Werman, also on the show, a conversation with the U.S. ambassador to China on the agenda, Taiwan, Ukraine, and the need for better communication.
If, God forbid, there is an accident between our military forces, you want to be able to intervene, lower the temperature, and defuse a crisis before it gets worse.
Plus, medieval comedy clubs.
We don't typically think of the 15th century as an especially happy time in England.
Despite wars, disease, and feudal lords, medieval folks found time for some laughs. That's all ahead today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thank you for joining us today. It is a race against time deep below the North Atlantic. The U.S. Coast Guard is looking for a deep-dive submersible and five people on board exploring the wreckage of the Titanic. Three of the passengers have been identified as underwater tourists, paying up to $250,000 to see the famous shipwreck up close. We called up Sal Mercogliano. He's the host of the YouTube channel What's Going On with Shipping. Sal is also a maritime historian. So the U.S. Coast Guard is searching an area the size of Connecticut, deep below the ocean. I know there's a protocol for search and rescue when the vessel or subjects are on the water's surface. How do you even go about locating an object below water? I mean, the grid suddenly becomes 3D and not 2D.
It becomes very difficult. I mean, this submersible is about the size of a minivan. And so a lot of the technology that you may be familiar with, sonar, all those things you see in World War II movies where they're pinging, it's very hard to find something at the depth of 13,000 feet. Even the military equipment is really geared to just within the first 1,000 feet of water. So when you start getting down to depths that Titanic is at, a lot of the technology we have does not work to find an object that is very small and very quiet.
Is it the U.S. Coast Guard's responsibility? I mean, the Titanic is closest to Newfoundland in Canada, and these are international waters, right?
Right. This is international waters. And this is a strange irony of this event is that because of the Titanic disaster in 1912, you literally had a treaty that was signed, what becomes known as SOLAS, the Safety of Life at Sea Convention, comes out of London, January 20th of 1914. And it literally mandated the fact that when vessels are in distress, all assets, all vessels have to respond. So if you know the story of Titanic, you know there weren't enough lifeboats on board. You may know they sent out a distress signal that wasn't heard by a ship because they weren't monitoring. So all those provisions are in place because of Titanic. However, the Titan is a submersible. It's not flagged in a country. It operates off a mothership. And therefore, it doesn't fall under the requirements of SOLAS. So a lot of the safety features you would see on a ship are not on a submersible.
That's really interesting. I mean, there are lots of questions being raised about the safety of this particular sub. I'd like us to hear a clip from the CBS News. This is from just last year.
And yet, I couldn't help noticing how many pieces of this sub seemed improvised.
We can use these off-the-shelf components.
I got these from Camper World. We run the whole thing with this game controller.
Come on!
What is your reaction to that description of the missing submersible?
This submersible is really designed to do an elevator, go to the bottom and come to the top. It doesn't have buoyancy tanks like a modern submarine, doesn't have engines really. It has these kind of fans that move it around. Very limited propulsion on board. And because this vessel operates off another vessel, it doesn't have to meet the state requirements of flying a flag. And therefore, there's not a lot of safety features that are built into it. Now, of course, they design safety features into it, or else you wouldn't be able to get people to go on it. However, there's not really the third parties that are out there inspecting them. If you have a foreign flag vessel sail into Boston, for example, the Boston Coast Guard, the U.S. Coast Guard in Boston can inspect those vessels. This doesn't work that way. It's very similar to putting a boat on the back of a trailer and driving down a road. The police, the state highway patrol will ensure that trailer is inspected and it meets the requirements. They don't really inspect the boat. And that's what you have in this scenario because that submersible is loaded on the back of the vessel in Canada out of St. John's, and then it's operating in international waters. So there's not a real provision to ensure that there's inspection. Now, usually there'll be third-party inspectors, what are called classification agencies. This is Lloyd's of London. This is the American Bureau of Shipping. But that's to insure the vessel. And that's a question of whether or not what type of insurance this vessel had as a submersible.
Let's talk briefly about extreme tourism. I mean, people paying really large sums of money to go deep below the ocean or into outer space. Are they conducting any science activities themselves, or is raising attention for the science a useful side effect of this kind of extreme tourism?
I think it is, you know, because you're going to depths that people don't get a chance to see. And I'll look at a guy like Paul Allen, one of the co-founders of Microsoft. He and his vessel, the Petrel, for years were doing these deep exploration ROV dives on World War II wrecks. And as a maritime historian, I can tell you, we learned a great deal by the wrecks that he found and more about the history of the events that unfolded, so that when he finds the Lexington at the bottom of the Coral Sea or the USS Johnston off the Philippines, you learn exactly what happened to those vessels in the last moments. What were the crew experiencing? And so, you know, many ways, shipwrecks are snapshots in time. They're really frozen in place. So you can learn a great deal, whether it's the bottom of the Marianas Trench or it's a Byzantine ship at the bottom of the Black Sea.
Sal Mercogliano, he's the host of the YouTube channel What's Going On with Shipping. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Marco. I appreciate it.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken's meeting yesterday with Chinese leader Xi Jinping was something of a high wire act. One misstep and the painstaking efforts to reestablish substantive communication between the two superpowers could come crashing down. Nicholas Burns, the U.S. ambassador to China, had a ringside seat. He was in the room when Blinken sat down with Xi. We reached out to Ambassador Burns this morning to hear how things went. We spoke about the meeting and how it unfolded, China's evolving relationships with Taiwan and Ukraine, and what a more stable U.S.-China relationship might look like.
We have to have the capacity to be able to discuss an ongoing set of disagreements on issues that really matter in the world. You know, we don't agree with what the Chinese have done militarily and trying to intimidate and coerce in the Taiwan Strait, for instance. We don't believe that China should be as supportive politically of what President Putin is doing in this illegal and barbaric invasion of Ukraine. We have a lot of concerns about Chinese mistreatment of American companies. There have been punitive actions taken by the Chinese government against five American companies just in the last couple of months. And the fentanyl crisis, of course, has hit America in every town and county across the United States, and the precursor chemicals that make up most of the fentanyl are exported by black market Chinese firms, private sector firms, to the drug traffickers in Mexico, and that fentanyl comes up, and it's the leading cause of death in the United States between adults 18 to 49. We're asking the Chinese, the government here, to shut down the flow of precursor chemicals. So you can't make progress on any of these issues if you're not meeting, and it had been 5 years, which is rather extraordinary when you think about it, between the last visit by a Secretary of State and this visit. So I know that Secretary Blinken felt, I saw him off at the airport last night, and he felt really good about the visit.
You went down a long list of things there, Ambassador. Lots of potential to the relationship, but as you point out, there are a lot of things that hang over the U.S.-China relationship. Most worrying, perhaps, Beijing has not agreed to resume military-to-military cooperation with the U.S. Why is Beijing hesitant to do that?
The problem is our two militaries operate in very close proximity in the Spratly and Paracel Islands of the South China Sea, in the East China Sea, and in the Taiwan Strait. And we want to make sure that when our Navy operates in international waters or when our Air Force operates in international airspace, which they are legally, of course, able to do and have a right to do, that everybody plays by the rules, that there aren't unsafe intercepts by Chinese aircraft and Chinese naval vessels. We've seen twice, Marco, in the last 3 weeks, incidents, one in the Taiwan Strait by naval vessels and one in the air, where we believe the People's Liberation Army here in China has acted irresponsibly and threatened to cause accidents. You need these military-to-military channels because if, God forbid, there is an accident between our military forces, you want to be able to intervene, lower the temperature, and diffuse a crisis before it gets worse. Why are the Chinese not accepting this? It's a very good question. We've asked that question. Secretary Blinken said repeatedly to the Chinese leadership, it's in the interest of both of our countries to make sure that we have contact with each other. Now, obviously, as the ambassador here, I have the ability to call people in the government in a crisis like that, and my staff does as well, but there's no substitute for military officers who are in close proximity to be able to have that communication at a moment's notice.
Looming all of this, of course, Ambassador, is the war in Ukraine. How did Ukraine come up in the discussions between Secretary Blinken and Xi Jinping, and where did things land?
Well, it was a big part of the discussion with the foreign minister and with Director Wang Yi. And what we have said very consistently is that obviously China has influence in Russia. They have a very close relationship. And we hope that the government of China will use its influence to convince President Putin to, frankly, stop the war. Now, the Chinese have launched somewhat of a diplomatic mission, and Ambassador Li Hui, who's an experienced Chinese diplomat, took a trip to Moscow and Kiev, to Warsaw, Berlin, and Paris as an attempt to try to begin discussions for how to end the war. We don't think they made much progress on that trip, but we said, look, if you can contribute to a peaceful resolution of this dispute that honors the territorial integrity and sovereignty of Ukraine, the victim, then of course we would be supportive of that. But I think it remains to be seen whether China is going to try to exercise that kind of honest broker role or whether China will continue, in essence, to provide political support to Putin.
At this point in time, Ambassador, do you see any indication that China might be providing Moscow with technology to help prosecute the Kremlin's war in Ukraine?
We have not seen indications that China has provided lethal military support to the Russian government for the war in Ukraine. But we're watching very carefully. We're going to continue to watch it. We raised this question, Secretary Blinken did, over the weekend. The Chinese know that we're watching. And we have a lot of concerns.
Yeah, a lot of people watching the situation look at the erosion of trust and the limited communication between Washington and Beijing and wonder what that might mean. For example, it is easy to imagine how relatively minor accidents during military exercises or surveillance operations could dramatically escalate. What are the leaders from the two countries doing to prevent that from happening?
Well, the U.S. has taken the position that it's precisely when we have tension in a relationship, and we do with China, when we have major differences on important issues, as we certainly do, it's precisely then when you need open diplomatic channels. Now, I have the ability, and my great team here at the embassy has the ability to talk to the Chinese foreign ministry. There's no problem in that. But we want to accompany that with military-to-military talks. That's the responsible thing to do. President Biden has talked a lot about the fact that we are in competition with China, and we certainly are, and we don't shy away from that. But he also believes, and we believe, that we've got to be responsible in the way that both sides wage that competition. We have a responsibility to make sure that we don't end up in conflict. And we certainly need to be responsible to have a peaceful relationship. The way you do that is you open the lines of communication so that we can talk to each other about difficult subjects. And if a crisis occurs, we can have instantaneous communication. We will continue to press this issue with the Chinese leadership. It makes perfect sense. And if you think about it, Marco, in the old Cold War, and the first 10 years of my own diplomatic career were the last 10 years of the old Cold War, we were able to get to a point 60 years ago after the Cuban Missile Crisis where President Kennedy and then President Johnson and their successors were able to have at least the assurance that we could reach the Soviet leadership during a crisis. We need to do that now with China. It's an important principle for us. As Secretary Blinken said in his press conference in Beijing before he left, he was going to persist on this in pressing for this, and I certainly am going to do that on behalf of him and President Biden.
Do the Chinese seem as concerned of something bad, accidental happening as you are expressing?
Oh, I think there are many people in the Chinese system who understand how important this is. We have to convince the People's Liberation Army and the Chinese Ministry of Defense to go along with this. But, you know, it's something that I think sooner or later is going to happen.
That's U.S. Ambassador to China Nicholas Burns speaking with us from Beijing. You'll hear more of our discussion with the ambassador in the second half of our show. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Health officials in Malaysia say their country has a cigarette problem. Nearly half of all men there smoke. The government wants everyone to kick the habit. Officials are pushing an anti-tobacco policy that some are hailing as visionary. Others say it's a violation of civil rights. The World's Patrick Nguyen has more.
Malaysia has tried to scare its citizens with TV ads depicting brains and lungs oozing black gunk.
Setiap sedutan membawa pada.
Every puff brings pain, says this public service announcement that aired a decade ago. There were once hopes that airing commercials like this and putting photos of diseased organs on cigarette packs would reduce smoking in Malaysia. But it barely made a dent. Neither did hiking taxes on cigarettes. So now officials are pushing a policy they call the end game. Anyone born after 2007 would be forbidden from buying cigarettes ever for their entire life. Here's Azrul Mode Khalib of the Galen Center.
Basically, what this envisages is to act as a generational gate against people who want to take up smoking.
It would be the most restrictive anti-smoking ban in the world. New Zealand passed a similar law, but the Malaysian version would go further by imposing penalties. Anyone born after 2007, even if they're, say, 30 years old in the year 2037, would get fined about $100 for smoking. The shopkeeper who sold them those cigarettes would face a fine of more than $2,000 and even jail time.
There is a significant amount of pushback. We should expect some legal challenges the moment the bill gets passed.
Khalib says someone will almost certainly sue, insisting the law violates their civil liberties. I asked him, won't Big Tobacco fight this as well?
Oh, absolutely. We are looking at a threat to their future business.
The law's opponents include Philip Morris and British American Tobacco, which compares the law to prohibition, the 1920s era alcohol ban in the U.S. that is widely considered a policy blunder. These companies say the law will fuel a black market for cigarettes. This is a fair concern because Malaysia already has a booming trade in illegal cigarettes. They're smuggled in from neighboring Indonesia, where cigarettes are cheaper. Thanks to higher taxes, a legal pack in Malaysia cost about $2.50. A smuggled-in pack, only $1. Azrul Khalib, the health policy expert, says cigarette trafficking gangs rely on corrupt police.
A massive amount of illicit tobacco products come into the country. There is a certain amount of collusion amongst the authorities themselves.
Malaysian officials admit that of all the cigarettes sold in their country, more than half are black market smokes. The country's parliament is still hashing out the endgame nicotine law. One hang-up is how to handle vaping. Some politicians say ban it, just like cigarettes. Others say leave it alone. Vaping is way less harmful to the lungs and brain. Some version of this law will likely pass. But Khalib says there are still lawmakers worried voters in their districts will hate it.
Quite a number of them are thinking about lower-income households where the smallest luxury really is smoking a cigarette at the end of the day. And it's felt that this is a way of taking away one of those small luxuries.
Malaysia does have universal health care. Proponents of the law say fewer rights is a small price to pay for fewer people dying from cancer. For The World, I'm Patrick Nguyen.
There's certainly no shortage of it, and now more worrying news on the climate change front. Ice and snow in the world's highest mountains are disappearing even faster than previously thought. The glaciers in the Hindu Kush and Himalaya mountain range melted 65% faster between 2010 and 19 than compared with the previous decade. According to a new report, the water supply for up to 2 billion people could be impacted. Isabella Kojul is the Deputy Director General of ISIMOD, which issued the report. She joins us from London. Your findings are not good news, Isabella. How surprising for you was it that the glaciers you study have been melting much faster than previously thought?
Well, not altogether that surprising. This has been going on for quite some time. This is the latest science and research that we've managed to put together and get out there. Of course, it's hard to imagine the scale of the problem and the scale of the impending disasters that will be associated with these melting glaciers. It's so huge, it's unimaginable. I mean, when you take the fact that the Hindu Kush Himalaya, that 2 billion people are dependent on the water for food, water for energy, water for domestic use, and the impacts are going to be huge.
And we're talking an area from Afghanistan in the west to Myanmar in the east. I mean, just what changes could people in this part of the world see in their daily lives in terms of water supply?
There are problems of too little water. So, for instance, take the farmer whose crops are repeatedly failing now every season because the rain is coming at different times of the year. Take the other extreme where you've got too much water and you've got communities whose entire homes, their villages are wiped out either because of a flood or a landslide.
I mean, we are already seeing how people from those floods in Pakistan were displaced internally. In a situation where water runs out, what's going to happen to those people? Where will they go? What will they do?
If those glaciers melt together with the Arctic and the Antarctic and other mountain glaciers, we're going to have sea level rise. We know that. So you're going to have people moving up from the coasts and people moving down from the mountains. So where will they go? That's why I say it will affect us all, because they will have to move to other countries and other regions.
Is the melting of these glaciers in the Himalayas and the Hindu Kush, is that continuing today?
It is continuing. So we know that already, if we continue with current emission trends, we will lose up to 80% of those glaciers in the next 70 years. Now, that is not so far away. We also know that the water flows from those glaciers will increase in the over the next 25 years and then decrease. So these time periods are not that far away. So that it is increasing, the situation is getting worse.
I mean, you sketched out nothing short of a catastrophic scenario, Isabella. What's being done either at the regional level or at the international level in this part of the world to get this under control? I mean, is it just back to the hard work of tackling greenhouse gas emissions?
Yes, the message is pretty simple. We have to decarbonize, and we have to decarbonize now. There is no time left. We must reduce greenhouse gas emissions. And whatever we invest in now will reduce the impacts and the costs to all of us in future. And we cannot expect poorer countries, lower income countries, to pay for these additional costs of all these catastrophes. Now, there is a lot of international climate finance beginning to flow, but it's taking too long to get to the people who need it most.
Isabella Kojal is the Deputy Director General of ISIMUD, which just put out a new report on the melting glaciers in the Hindu Kush mountain range. She spoke to us from London. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
You're with the world. El Salvador is cracking down hard on gang members. Anyone even suspected of being in a gang can get nabbed, including foreigners just visiting.
The police comes and they just arrest you because they think that you were planning to commit some crimes.
Plus, buried in the archives of 15th century England, punchlines. Still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH and PRX. Economic sanctions, one tactic used by Washington and its allies to weaken Russia. Some American partners, though, are not on board, like the United Arab Emirates. In fact, since the start of the war, the UAE has been stepping up its engagement with Russia. Just last week, UAE President Mohammed bin Zayed was in St. Petersburg shaking hands with Vladimir Putin. Bin Zayed thanked the Russian president and said his own country is ready to help, quote, pacify the situation in Ukraine. The World's Shirin Jafari reports from the UAE on one way the war is actually benefiting the Gulf nation.
On a recent day in Dubai, construction crews were busy working on a new residential property. This apartment building is scheduled to be ready in 4 years. The location is in high demand these days. It's called Palm Jumeirah, a man-made archipelago in the shape of a palm tree.
The prices have just surged ridiculously here over the last 2 years.
Luke Remington is the managing director for a Dubai real estate agency called the House & House Group. He tells me his company has seen a dramatic jump in demand for UAE real estate in the past 2 years. So much demand, he says, there is not enough supply. Eager buyers are paying in cash and in crypto.
If you'd come to Dubai 5 years ago, you'd probably be kicking yourself and thought, why didn't I buy?
Prices vary. Until recently, he says the highest priced property in Dubai was around $50 million. Today, he hears every week from buyers who are spending more than $100 million on places.
It's a lot of people coming in with lots of money.
Among the people coming in are Russians. They made up the biggest international group of buyers in Dubai last year. That's according to Better Homes, a real estate firm that operates in the city. On average, they spend $1 million per property, with some paying much, much higher prices. This surge in Russian money entering the UAE has raised concerns that the Gulf state has become a destination for Russians trying to avoid sanctions or taking part in money laundering activities abroad. Jody Vittori is an anti-corruption expert at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
It's a place where few questions are asked of the source of funds, and the answers that you need to give are quite perfunctory.
Publicly available data on property sales in Dubai are scarce, but one US-based NGO called C4ADS has used leaked data to track buyers. It found that businessmen and officials with links to Russia's President Vladimir Putin now own properties in Dubai valued collectively at more than $300 million. Last March, the Financial Action Task Force, a global money laundering and terrorist financing watchdog, added the UAE to its grey list. Alex Zerdin, a former U.S. Treasury official, says the UAE has not signed on to Western sanctions against Russia, and it has tried to maintain a good relationship with the Kremlin.
There are attempts underway by the Emirati government to remediate illicit finance concerns in areas like real estate, digital assets, and cryptocurrencies.
The UAE's anti-money laundering and anti-terrorism financing office did not respond to an interview request for this story. Zerdin says that the U.S. has sent sanctions experts to the UAE to discuss the issue, and there are some signs that it might be having an impact. In March, the UAE cancelled the license of one Russian bank that had branches there. But Jody Vittori from the Carnegie Endowment says the UAE needs to do more.
Certainly, one has to admire the UAE and Dubai in particular for such a tiny state that really 60 years ago had Dubai had 60,000 people in a census in the 1960s that had no international airport, that has no decent port, has no decent fresh water. One really has to admire what the UAE has done. But nonetheless, to quote from Spider-Man, with great power comes great responsibility.
In other words, if the UAE wants to remain part of the Western financial system and benefit from US security support, it will need to clamp down on illicit activities.
This will probably be handled over in the next 4 years.
Luke Remington from the real estate agency shows me the rest of the soon-to-be-for-sale property on Palm Jumeirah. The views are pretty stunning, with gleaming blue waters all around and rows of palm trees. I asked Remington if he worries about where the financing for the sale of these properties come from. He says every sale has to pass an anti-money laundering inspection.
Well, I think it's unfair to probably necessarily say, you know, the Russians have got money that is problematic or gained from reasons that shouldn't be, you know. We can't just say we can't take Russia money. It's as legitimate as anyone else unless proven otherwise.
Soccer stars, celebrities, and other high rollers from all over the world own luxury homes here, he says. A short distance away is the Atlantis, the fancy hotel where Beyoncé reportedly performed for $24 million. Dubai, it appears, will continue to attract the super rich, sanctions or no sanctions. For The World, I'm Shirin Jafari in Dubai.
So this knight walks into a bar. Yeah, when you think back on medieval history, you probably don't think of a time of great jokesters. The word medieval itself doesn't connote really anything funny. I suggest you put away those suppositions. It turns out people living in the Middle Ages had their own version of stand-up. James Wade has found evidence of that. He's a professor of medieval literature at Girton College at the University of Cambridge. So, James, what did you find out and how did you find it? And what period of time are we talking about here?
So we're talking about the late 15th century, so the 1480s. And what I found was a manuscript that was written in the Midlands of England at that time by a scribe named Richard Hege. And this manuscript is now in the special collections of the National Library of Scotland. And I was in the reading room there looking for tales of adventure, tales of chivalry, knights of the round table, you know, those kinds of texts. When I came across a manuscript that had some really strange comic poetry, some nonsense poetry. And that material got me thinking about what this manuscript was used for.
Yeah, so read us some of what you found and how you came to the conclusion that this was stand-up, or at least an attempt to tell jokes or be funny in front of a crowd.
There is a really striking moment when the scribe of this manuscript, so the person who copied it out, he ends a poem with a signature line, what we call a colophon, and it says, "By me, Richard Hege, because I was at that feast and did not have a drink." The joke being that, you know, there was a feast the night before, everyone drank too much, and he was the only one sober enough to remember it and then write it down the next morning.
You can trust his account, in other words.
Exactly. He's a reliable, sober witness. But this is unusual for two reasons. One, it's an example of a scribe from the Middle Ages showing something of their sense of humor, their character. The other thing that's so interesting is it suggests that the origins of this material isn't from a previous manuscript copied out into another one, but rather live performance. And so that's what got me thinking about the possibilities of live entertainment.
Can you read some of that for us?
So Middle English is the language, the version of English that was spoken in England in the Middle Ages. And one of the texts in this manuscript is a mock religious sermon.
Mm.
And so I'll give you a couple of sentences in medieval English, and then I'll give you a translation.
Okay.
"If thou have a great black ball in thy honda, and yet be full of good all, and thou leave anything therein, thou puttest thy soul into great pena. And thereto accordest two worthy preachers, Jacques Throm and Jean Brestbale. This man said in the Bible that an ill drinker is impossible heaven for to winna, for good is love, neither horse nor mare, but merely mended in the cup con style."
All right. I mean, I don't speak Middle English, but I certainly didn't get a punchline there. So help us out here.
Yeah. All right. So I'll give you the translation here. "If you have a big tankard in your hand and it's full of good beer, you put your soul at great risk if you don't drink all of it." Huh. And this accords with two worthy men, Jack Athrum and John Brestbale. These men said in the Bible that it is impossible for a bad drinker to go to heaven, because God loves neither horse nor mare, but merry men who will in the cup stare.
Wow.
And so what you see there is a kind of inversion of a Eucharistic image, the drinking of the wine, but also, of course, the idea that God rewards those who behave appropriately in a tavern or an alehouse or a pub. And the way to behave appropriately is, of course, to drink a lot.
James, give us some context here. I mean, this is the Middle Ages. Who were the comedians, if we can call them that? Where did they perform? Who were the audiences?
This manuscript is really revealing in terms of the situations or occasions for these live performances. The implication is that it's a scene of festivities, of drinking, of eating, of merriment, of games, maybe a fair, maybe a festival. It could be a tavern or an alehouse or a pub. But the gist is that it's a place where people are enjoying themselves on an evening.
Is this a happy time in England? I mean, did people need kind of humor in their lives?
We don't typically think of the 15th century as an especially happy time. Civil War, the War of the Roses, famine, about the kind of oppression of the feudal system. It's interesting to see that despite all of that, people were finding ways to enjoy themselves and to be happy and merry with each other in community.
What do we know about the people who actually performed these jokes, who told these jokes?
We don't know anything about the actual performer. We know about the scribe who was at the performance and wrote it down. This is one of the most interesting things about performances in the Middle Ages, is that we don't have a single manuscript that survives that we know was owned by one of these performers or even used by one of these performers. And so to have a manuscript that is a copy of a performance is a really kind of rare and exciting opportunity to get a glimpse from the Middle Ages that would otherwise be lost.
James Wade is a professor of medieval literature at Girton College at the University of Cambridge. He's been speaking to us about what appears to be a medieval version of stand-up comedy. James, thanks very much.
Thanks, Marco. Appreciate it.
In El Salvador, thousands of people have been imprisoned over the past 15 months. It's part of the government's crackdown to stop gang violence. Many people in El Salvador say they're happy with the plan, despite the suspension of civil liberties. Others warn that the police have gone too far and are now arresting foreign visitors, including citizens of the U.S., Guatemala, and Colombia. Manuel Rueda has our story from the Colombian capital, Bogota.
On January 19, Jose Botes traveled to El Salvador from Colombia, hoping to find work. Botes is a welder, and he was looking for a country where he could earn wages in U.S. dollars and send money home to his family. But soon, the 24-year-old's journey turned into a nightmare.
Entonces, a nosotros nos pierden los papeles.
Botes says that during his second day in El Salvador, he was detained by a military patrol as he left a shopping mall with a friend. They checked his passport and then turned him over to the police. They took us to a police station and they strip searched us, he says. Then they started to take photos of our tattoos. Botes has a tattoo with his grandmother's name on it. It covers the left half of his chest and also shows some hands holding a rosary. He says that was enough for police to be suspicious and have him locked up with his friend.
Entonces él me dice que estamos detenidos, que porque nosotros pertenecemos a la pandilla 18.
They accused us of being members of Barrio 18, a gang that doesn't even exist in Colombia, he says. It was outrageous. Botes ended up spending 4 months in Salvadorian jails. At one point, he was in a cell with no bathrooms, where prisoners only had a few buckets to defecate in.
No hay cómo dormir, no caben las personas. O sea, eso está topado de gente, pero topado de gente.
He says that many people had to sleep on the floor due to the lack of space. As horrible as this sounds, it's not unique. More than 67,000 people have been imprisoned in El Salvador since March of last year, as President Nayib Bukele deploys emergency measures to curb gang violence. It's been called the state of exception, and it enables police to arrest anyone they think is part of a gang. Suspects can be held in prison for an unlimited amount of time while their cases are investigated. Leonor Arteaga is an expert on El Salvador with the Due Process of Law Foundation.
The police arrest you because they think that you were planning to commit some crimes.
Police are snatching so many people that dozens of foreigners have also been arrested. Most are being held for a crime called criminal association, which basically means being a gang member, says Arteaga.
In many cases, detentions appear to be based on simply like the detainee's appearance, their social background, or in general, in very questionable evidence.
The government of El Salvador has not published any stats on how many foreigners it's arrested during the state of exception. But Botes, the Colombian who was detained for 4 months, says he saw people of several nationalities while he was in prison.
Habían hondureños, panameños, de República Dominicana.
From Honduras and from Panama, he says, and also from the Dominican Republic and Guatemala. Botes says that in February, 72 foreigners, including himself, were transferred from the Soyapango prison to a smaller jail in Jucuapa. U.S. officials have also noted this situation. In March, the State Department issued a travel alert for El Salvador, which said that several U.S. citizens had been arrested there in an arbitrary manner. And that continues to happen. In May, U.S. citizen Walter Huetes was detained in El Salvador when he attended a party with some friends. Huetes is a native of Los Angeles who has Salvadorian roots. His wife, Jenny Bustillo, says that he was in the country to help his stepdaughter with a visa application. His arrest was totally arbitrary, Bustillo says. It looks like they grabbed him just because he has some tattoos. Huetes has a small cross on his wrist and an LA Dodgers logo on his right hand. Like most people who are arrested under the state of exception, he hasn't been allowed to call his family, although he's spoken to a U.S. consular officer. What is happening is very unfair, Bustillo says. We are contractors and we have a new business, and it's fallen apart because he's not here. Despite these arrests, the state of exception is popular with many Salvadorians because crime has fallen drastically. However, Leonor Arteaga worries that while Bukele remains popular, civil rights are deteriorating.
For some people, that might not seem that important, that relevant, but when you are the victim of this scenario with no rights, now you see how high is the price that we pay.
Politicians in places like Guatemala and Ecuador have said they want to emulate Bukele's policies. But those who have been on the receiving end of these measures have a warning.
No.
You don't want to go there, says Jose Botes. Thousands of innocent people are being locked up. and they won't even let you call your mother. For the World, I'm Manuel Rueda, in Bogota.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken's meeting this week with Chinese leader Xi Jinping was not a sure thing. In fact, Monday's meeting reportedly was not even confirmed until 45 minutes before the two men shook hands. In their talk, Secretary Blinken pushed Xi on several issues, including China's military activities near Taiwan and Beijing's relationship with Moscow. One of Blinken's key objectives was to reopen military-to-military discussions, something Beijing did not agree to. Still, some doors may have been nudged open. Earlier on the show today, you heard the first part of my discussion with U.S. Ambassador to China Nicholas Burns. Let's pick up the thread now as Burns talks about how he tries to manage the U.S. relationship with China and how Washington could reopen high-level channels of communication with Beijing.
We had these channels until the Chinese closed them back in the first week of August 2022, following in their protest. We thought it was unjustified, but their protest over Speaker Pelosi's visit. It's just a question of turning them back on. I should say, Marco, they also froze at that time our climate change talks, and they've since reengaged. They froze our anti-narcotics talks. That's on fentanyl. We've been having trouble talking to them about that, but they have a responsibility on an acute issue like that that I think Americans feel very deeply about. The government here has a responsibility to help us out and stop the flow of these precursor chemicals. So, you know, this is a very difficult relationship to manage. There are some issues where we can work well with the Chinese. There are many where we cannot, but we don't give up. We show up at work every day. We're working hard to make this a more effective relationship.
Amid all of these high-level points of tension, I'm wondering where the space is now for the U.S. to continue pressing China on human rights. For example, what's to be done about what's been widely called a genocide of Muslim Uyghurs in Western China?
Well, Secretary Blinken raised these issues in a very forthright way on Sunday and Monday here in Beijing with the Chinese leadership. He talked about our opposition to forced labor and what they're doing in Xinjiang. He talked about human rights violations in Tibet. He also discussed the denial of freedom to the people of Hong Kong and the dramatic change we've seen in the crackdown on civil liberties there. He also raised specific cases of Chinese individuals who've been thrown in jail for exercising rights that we think that all people should have. We don't shy away from promoting human rights here. We've got a lot of issues on the agenda here that are vital to the future of America, but we are a democratic country that deeply believes in human rights for all people. And so, as a matter of course, I raise these issues on a very regular basis with the Chinese leadership, and we won't stop doing that.
What role does the U.S.-China economic codependence have in salvaging this relationship?
It's an irony. At the same time that we've had so many disagreements in the relationship, our two-way trade relationship grew last year to $690 billion. China's now our third largest trade partner after Canada and Mexico. And so it's actually a very important place for American businesses. The U.S.-China Business Council in a recent report said that about 1 million Americans' jobs depend on trade with China. Secretary Blinken was very open. You know, we're not trying to decouple the American economy from the Chinese economy. We're not trying to end all trade between China and the United States, but we are trying to de-risk. What does that mean? It means that, you know, we learned in COVID, during the COVID years, we were too dependent on China for certain critical minerals and critical materials. So we're trying to diversify our supply chain so that we don't end up in a crisis unduly dependent on China. And on technology, which is really the heart of the competition between us, we've taken actions over the last year or so to prevent the export of certain American advanced technologies like advanced semiconductors that could be used by the Chinese against us for military purposes, for the development of sophisticated military weapons. And there is no reason why we would want to do that. In fact, we want to shut off the possibility that American military technology could end up being used against us. So we have a very hard-headed approach to the economic relationship. It's important in the field like agriculture. China's our largest market for American farmers and ranchers and for the American fishing industry. But on certain technology grounds, we're going to begin to take tough actions to block the export of technologies that could be injurious to our national security.
Which side do you think is more responsible, really, for the deterioration of the U.S.-China relationship?
Well, look, I mean, obviously the United States believes that we've tried to put our best foot forward here. You know, we look at the relationship this way, Marco. It's a highly competitive relationship on human rights, on technology, on the lack of a level playing field for American businesses, certainly from a security perspective. You know, we want to maintain the power of the American military working for our ally, with our allies Japan and Australia and South Korea here in the Indo-Pacific. We're competing with China in all of those realms. But on the other hand, obviously, we're the two largest carbon emitters, so we have a self-interest and, frankly, a responsibility to work with them on climate change. So the relationship is a lot of competition, probably the majority of what we do, but we want to live in peace with China and cooperate when we can. It's that kind of a relationship, and that balance is a difficult one to strike. I was back in Washington last week. I met with many members of Congress, both in the House and Senate, and while there are some differences on Capitol Hill, in the large measure, I think most Republicans and Democrats agree we've got to compete, but we also have to engage at some point with the Chinese. And I think getting that balance right is tricky, but I think we've got it largely right. And so we think we've acted in the right way here. We don't think it's right for the Chinese to shut down channels of communication. So that's our major issue right now. We're trying to stabilize the relationship in a responsible way.
That's U.S. Ambassador to China, Nicholas Burns, speaking with us from Beijing. Ambassador, thank you very much for your time.
Marco, thank you very, very much.
Now that Secretary Blinken's trip to Beijing is in the rearview mirror, the Biden administration turns to the next major event on the diplomatic calendar, one that's also Asia-focused, the visit to Washington of Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi, including a state dinner on Thursday. Blinken described the U.S. and India as big, complicated countries. Among the complications for the U.S., India's willingness to purchase cheap Russian oil despite U.S. sanctions, Modi's stifling of dissent, and statements like this one from India's foreign minister, who recently said, "There are no allies or friends, only frenemies." President Biden has made it clear strong ties to the world's largest democracy are critical. Before Modi gets to Washington later this week, he's stopping in New York. Tomorrow, he'll lead an International Yoga Day event at the United Nations. The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe, stay strong, and we'll see you right back here tomorrow.
From PRX.